Texas Absolute Rally, powered by the Kielder Works team. Cordless tools tailored for the world of motorsport.
Hello everyone, welcome to Absolute Rally. Season 15, episode 6. It was Hump Podcast last week. We're now on the downward spiral towards the end of this season. Anyway, without further ado, it's just me and Ryan again this week. Jack Benyon's got a note. He's still writing up his reports from grass tracking, so it's just me and Ryan. Hello, Ryan.
Hello.
We've got a cracking show. Slightly different show. We've got stuff. We've got the guys from Codemasters joining us a little bit later on. We've got Kev Ferber, who was part of, and you were part of as well, and the Peugeot reunion coming up towards the end of the podcast as well. So it's just you and me this week. There's some bits and pieces to chew over. Listen, I wanted to address a couple of things, Ryan Champion, before we go any further, because I can edit this podcast, Ryan Champion, as well, you know. And I choose not to edit it sometimes. I choose to leave in some faux pas, even though people may find that hard to believe. I do. So when we get a hard time for leaving the faux pas in, it makes me think, should I edit out the faux pas? What's your opinion on that, Ryan Champion?
I think that depends. Because sometimes you don't edit them out, and sometimes you have to edit them out.
Yeah, it's not very often I do. Not very often I do, because it's just time, normally.
And then some people listen to the ones where you haven't edited them out, and then, you know. Do you remember when we used to be live and we couldn't edit anything out?
That was difficult, let alone anything else. But I try to do this as live, so I tend to leave stuff in, unless it's, you know, monumentally bad. But I kind of try to, we record it as live, because you've just mentioned, of course, we did live programs. You know, that seems like a lifetime ago.
It does, but it's definitely easier when we can ring somebody back if they get cut off, like Craig Breen last week.
Yeah, should we tell our listeners how many attempts that lovely piece of edited piece put together? That was somewhere in the region, ladies and gentlemen, and if you can spot the edit, then good on you. That was seven different phone calls pieced together.
And probably about 200 kilometres across.
Across Andorra.
Yeah. Well, maybe not Andorra, because I don't know how big Andorra is.
No, neither do I. So there you go. So I do leave stuff in, and yes, I do make mistakes, and I have apologised accordingly. We've been picked up, by the way, that Thomas Radstrom wasn't Dennis Radstrom's dad.
We have, and now EWRC results have corrected it as well, because that's where I checked it from.
Yeah, so, do you know what? It made me feel a little bit better about myself when I seen they had the same thing. So, and they had to change it. So, apologies to the Radstrom family for getting siblings wrong.
And it's Rodstrom. We've been picked up on that as well.
Yes, we have been picked up on it, to be fair.
But then if people are going to pick us up on everything, we could be here a while. The good thing is, it proves somebody listens.
It does prove something. Well, to be fair, I've got the listener figure, so I know people listen. But yeah, it does prove people do listen. But yeah, there you go. So
can I just say hello to the man walking his dog? I don't know who the gentleman is, but he was driving a Mark II at the weekend, and he stopped me and said he loves the podcast and he listens to it when he's walking his dog. So hello to you, sir, walking your dog.
Walkies. There you go. Do you ever remember? I can remember we went to a dinner, both you and I and our respective partners, a charity ball that you and your good lady put together. And I was sat next to Jason Lepley. And Jason Lepley told me that particular night, we were a few bottles of red in at this point, that he listens to us in the bath. Now, I'm not entirely sure whether Jason still listens to us in the bath, but you've missed a bit if you have. There you go. There you go. Just thought I'd mention that. Anyway, rallying stuff, we better get back to it, haven't we, right? We better focus. Focus. I just wanted to mention a couple of things. We spoke about it briefly on last week's podcast. The benching of Andreas Mikkelsen. I don't want to dwell on it too much, but the guys at MN have put out a story today with regards to a piece that they did with the new head of Hyundai. I'm going to ask you just to clear this one up for me, Ryan Champion, because it's Andreas Adamuno, is it? Is that, am I pronouncing that one right?
Don't ask me pronunciations. That's the second time I've done that.
I know. I'm sorry.
But we'll leave that one to you.
But he said it was a strategic call, and apparently I always love a sauce, by the way. I don't mean tomato or brown, but basically one of his rivals at the end of the piece says, I think he wanted it called a no-brainer. So in other words, one of the rival bosses said it was a no-brainer to do this, basically to put out the strongest team. Now, he comes from an era, he's Italian, he makes reference in the piece to the days of Lancia, and remembers how dominant those guys were. And this is him basically putting out the strongest possible team. Do you think this will happen more throughout the season, Roy?
Well, they've set the precedent now, haven't they? But I guess it all comes back to how many rallies Sebastian Loeb actually wants to do and how his performance goes. Because, you know, Sweden was relatively underwhelming, wasn't it, for Sebastian Loeb. He said in Monte Carlo the car still wasn't quite to his liking. He struggled a little bit in Sweden. So I guess it'll depend on how well he starts to go and what his speed's like. But I guess, you know, in terms of a tarmac rally, having Thierry Neuville, Danny Sordo and Sebastian Loeb, why not? Why not? I mean, you know, Andreas Mikkelsen at the same time will probably say, well, you know, I've had some good results on tarmac, which he has, but, you know, he's just not gelling with that car for some reason at the minute, and it might give him a little bit of time to work that one out. So, they've got four drivers, so why wouldn't you put out your strongest team for the rallies?
Danny Sordo was out last weekend in an R5. He won over in Pfaff. Now, I've got a bit of it's not a theory because the facts are there. Obviously, I don't know what, I haven't looked at EWRC.com, our friends there, to see what, who else was out on that particular rally, but, you know, Danny won that event in an R5 car. Danny's very much on a renaissance, and do you think we could see Danny with a full-time seat maybe somewhere else next year? Do you think he's still got that appetite for a full-time seat?
No, I don't. Funnily enough, and that was something I remember talking to Stefan Prevost about that, funnily enough, and Stefan said that, you know, he doesn't see it in Danny that Danny wants that. But you're right, he's driving very well, but maybe that's because he isn't having to commit to a full season. Maybe that is because he's got a little bit more time to himself. But, you know, we talk about him as if he's an old driver at the end of his career. He was Chris Meek's rival in JWRC. You know, we've touched on this before, that Chris hasn't had that many full-time seasons in the championship. It just seems funny that, you know, we look at somebody like Danny and think, oh, well, he's getting a chance to come back and doing a few rallies, where, you know, we're still keen to see Chris Meek and get a full year.
Just going to the driver lineups, you know, do we even dare to try and figure out what's going to happen in 2020, so early into 2019? You know, who is going to be around? Do you think we're going to see Loeb next year? Do you think this is a swan song season?
I think it'll depend on how the rest of the season goes. I think if he can get the car working for him, you know, at the end of the day, he's made the jump, hasn't he now? He's made the jump to a different team, a team that are well-funded, that should be in the championship for, you know, certainly the next couple of years. If he can get comfortable in that car and if he gets the results, I think we might see him back next year. If by the end of this year he's finishing fifth and sixth and he's still not comfortable in it, we'll probably not see him, I would guess.
Yeah, it almost feels like there could be this change in the guard almost. You know, you think about, that's why, one of the reasons why I mentioned Danny then. You know, you think about Danny Sordo, you think about obviously Sebastian Loeb. You know, could this open up seats again? You know, we had Craig Breen on a course last week, and Craig was adamant we'd see him in WRC before the end of the season. Whether that's going to be in a private car or whatever, we really, really don't know. But seats need to open up again, don't they?
They do, yeah, because let's not forget the younger drivers, if you like, the likes of Craig Breen, the Hayden Paddens, have been pushed out by, you know, by the older drivers either coming back or you know, or staying on, as it were. So there's definitely a lot of good drivers that we want to see in the sport. You know, I can fully understand why Hyundai put Sebastian Loeb in a car. He is a 9-times world champion. He won last year. And he's still obviously very, very capable, and he must be hungry, or else they wouldn't be putting him out for this many rallies.
I wanted to talk about something which you and I have both, you've been a lot more involved in it than me, but Front Page of MN Today makes a big reference to the fact that irresponsible spectators are going to be are going to feel the force of authority, road rally fans to be hunted down. I've done Car Zero, you've done Car Zero, you know, probably a lot more than me, and you've also been on the rallies committee. Some big clampdown and the full force of whatever laws they seem to can be putting out. In an ideal world, I'd love to get Stuart Robinson on, but basically they're employing new high-level technology to show where these people are. And the message is simple. We'll know where you are and we'll come and get you.
Yeah, it's one of those things that has always been an issue to a degree, in that people do move around, don't they? And that's what organisers have tried to stop over the years. They've tried to have spectator areas, so it limits the movement of people, because obviously, you know, previously it's been relatively easy for the safety cars to go through, for the zero car to go through, and then for people to move down the road. And we saw a move towards spectator pens, if you like, but obviously that's hated by true rally fans. So it's certainly a balancing act, but ultimately if we want rallying to be around for the foreseeable future, then we can't have incidents with spectators, because with health and safety and responsibility the way it is now, if there's accidents, it will finish the sport.
I think that's what kind of needs to happen. You know, they're talking about perhaps the issues not being necessarily at the highest level, although geez, we have seen some frightening sights at the highest level. I find staggering, to be honest with you, some of the things that we have seen, certainly over the last 2 years, you know, with since the supercars of 17 spec cars have come in. But let's be honest, you know, a Group N car, you don't want to be arguing with. It doesn't really matter, it's a rally car going at full force. But the report, you know, Robinson's saying in this particular piece here is that it seems to be a lot more issues at national level. And you just can't help but feel that maybe some of the people that I've gone and watched national rallies, and I'm massively generalizing here, I realize that, you know, in whatever country, I can only speak for this country, having competed over here, but, you know, there'll be people who have had a little bit more freedom perhaps on national events, and then have perhaps gone to a world championship event and are not used to being probably told what to do, and not used to being, as you said before, herded into pens or whatever it may be, and will go, well, this is the way I go watching rallying, I'm going to watch rallying the way it is. And I don't really know what we can do to get through to those ones, right? Because to be fair, you could almost say, you know, these people have grown up watching rallying that way.
Yeah, and that's why everybody, you know, the people that used to go spectating on the RAC rally, on you know, all the rally GBs, and that's what people loved. They, you know, I still get casual rally fans saying, "Oh yeah, I remember walking into the forest and walking along the side of the road, getting hit by stones," and that's one of the things that people have loved about rallying over the years. You could get very close to the car, you choose your own spectator point, and that's where you stood. And like we said, it's just that things have changed nowadays in terms of health and safety and responsibility. So it is a difficult balance. We want to encourage spectators in the sport. We need spectators in the sport. You know, there's nothing worse than going to a rally and not seeing any spectators. And also it's a hard job for the marshals. You know, like marshals, we have some fantastic marshals out there, and some people are quite assertive and happy to move people on, but you also get other marshals that don't like to upset people and find it difficult to move somebody who's maybe straight into a difficult area. So it's something we've all got to be aware of in the sport.
Do you know what? Right, and I agree with you, but I'm just going to play devil's advocate just a little bit here. Do we really need spectators?
Well, from my point of view, yes. I mean, okay, you can say it's all about competitors, but you know, I still love to go watching a rally that I might not be doing, and you know, I think there's certainly a lot of people who just go spectating out there who love the sport, and I think if it got to a situation where we didn't have spectators, that would be really sad.
Yeah, but I guess if we didn't have any, then we wouldn't have these problems. The reason why I put it out there, and listen, I want spectators. I think that, you know, spectators, you know, I've talked about it, you know, for years. You know, you think about, I can't imagine going through the bowl on GB at Sweet Lamb or something like that, and not having that kind of spectator feel, which is like, you know, to me it's like a football stadium almost grabbing through there when you've got a lot of speckies in there. That is something very, very special. But there's a lot of single venues now, especially ones on military brand land and things like that, where they don't allow spectators, right? And they're not going to have those problems.
No, which is fine, but that's a rally for competitors, isn't it? It's a rally for competitors. It's a rally for the people who are doing it. I guess that sort of answers the question a little bit. It depends where you're aiming the rally at. Spectators have been a big source of income for rallies. Ironically, in this country, over the years, most of the money's gone to the Forestry Commission, but certainly rallies overseas make a significant amount of money from spectators. So it depends on the rally, definitely, but I certainly think rallying would be very much the poorer without spectators.
Yeah. I agree, but I guess I think what we've got to be careful of, we could end up in that world and that environment where, you know, no one's prepared to underwrite a rally with spectators.
And it may well happen, but if you talked about the ball in Sweet Lamb, well, spectators are perfectly safe there. There's always a way of accommodating spectators, but then you get into problems like we just talked about, where people don't want to be in the pens and try and venture somewhere else into the forest. And then if there is an issue, then that's maybe the sort of people that they need to clamp down on. But I think we always need spectator areas, at least.
There you go, folks. If you've got any views on this, by the way, by all means, if you want to email in studio@absoluterally.co.uk or tweet us, obviously you can respond to when we put the feed out to the show and let us know what your thoughts are anyway. I just wanted to fast forward on the R5 thing, right, which you and I have debated long and hard, and you know, we all love it, but we've all had concerns about costs and things like that. There seems to be a little bit of an uplift recently, certainly by some of the other marks. And I'm talking about, you know, the announcement of Kaito Kaitanovic running in a Raymond Bauschleicher R5 Polo. Alexei Lukyanuk, I think I've seen the report somewhere, is he going to be in a Hyundai? I think I've seen. And by all means, somebody put me straight on that. But it's just interesting now that we've got these guys that perhaps have been, you know, it was pretty much a two horse race, I think, for the last few years with the Fiesta and I guess the Skoda most definitely. But we've now got people actively being pushed into these other marks, which I think is going to be great.
Yeah, it certainly gives more variation, more interest, and ultimately all these manufacturers are in there to make money, to sell more cars. So the more manufacturers that build R5 cars, then the more there are pushing to get drivers in them. And it's funny because the Volkswagen is limited supply for this year, but there seems to be an awful lot of drivers in Volkswagens already.
Yeah, I wonder how limited that supply really was. I don't know. It's one of them, I guess, that I have noticed that. And I've also noticed that there's an incredible amount of Hyundai suddenly starting to appear as well. And whether that's a conscious decision by those guys, right, to perhaps get cars out there and go toe-to-toe. Because I don't know about you, I had a genuine fear that perhaps, you know, the signing of Sebastian Loeb, and, you know, obviously he brings a certain amount of attention to the team, but perhaps not bringing any kind of finances, that maybe, you know, the R5 program might get canned in favour. But it seems to have gone the other way, where they really kind of ramped things up.
Yeah, I don't think they can afford to can it, because it has to make money. You know, they've spent all the money developing the car. They've homologated the car. The big chunk of the money's spent. So they have to get money back in. And the only way to get money back in is by selling cars. So whether that involves them running more, you know, more cars from Hyundai Motorsport to get more awareness, as they've done with Danny Sordo recently, as you said, but they have to get cars out because they have to sell cars. They've got to recoup that investment.
Yeah, absolutely. I guess it'll be interesting to see how all these cars kind of fare. Obviously, Lukyanuk, I think I'm getting the impression that he's going to do a WRC2. Now, Obviously, Mads Osberg was dominant in Sweden. Although, again, no disrespect to Mads, I felt like all I did was watch videos of Mads testing in the week leading up to Sweden. I think he was pretty much max fit on snow and ice in that particular car. But obviously, he was in the pro section, and there's not going to be a Volkswagen pro section from my understanding, right? But it's not going to be a bad car, is it?
No. Again, this comes back to this, to me, this unnecessary pro and amateur thing. Like you said, Mats Osberg won the pro section, but he didn't win R5. But he's been quite critical of the car since then, saying that the car needs much further development and that he felt very uncomfortable in it. So I was quite surprised in how spoken Mats Osberg was in his comments about the Citroën afterwards. But like I said, all these cars are out there, have been developed. We're obviously seeing the Proton introduced now as well, and ultimately they cost a lot of money to develop, and the only way to recoup that is to sell cars. And it's good for R5. It's good for the rallies to get more variation in there. And it's amazing how many customers there are for these £200,000 plus rally cars.
It is, and then some, £200,000 plus, and then some. Dare I say?
Plus extras.
Yeah, plus your seats, plus your sump guard, plus your tank guard, plus your intercom, plus your windscreen, plus your wings, your doors, your bonnet. Anyway, it's getting silly now. I want to bring attention to an event that you and I I've done year on year back in the day, and Jack Benyon, I don't know if you remember him, folks. He used to be quite a regular contributor on our podcast in seasons gone by, but Jack will be back with us next week. But anyway, basically he's done a story with regards to the closed road issues right up in Scotland, and it seems to be getting a little bit, a step closer with regards to a positive future for closed road rallying up there.
Yeah, which is great, and obviously this links back to what you were talking about a little bit earlier on with spectators. If there is closed road rallies, then it's got to be very well organised, very well run, very safety conscious because of the issues that the Jim Clark rally had a few years ago. But ultimately, it's fantastic news. I think Mull Rally, all the people who went to it and were on it. Know just how special that rally was, and it's really important to get that rally back. And likewise, the Jim Clark. I mean, we probably didn't realise just how special that event was until it had gone. And two amazing closed road rallies in Scotland, and obviously a full road closure would, or the ability to do that without an Act of Parliament would allow other tarmac events as well up there. It'd be great to see more rallies, but it'd be fantastic to get those two key rallies back again.
It's not very often I do this, because I'm gonna read a section that Jack's wrote, kind of verbatim. A 98% positive reaction. If only the other 2% better than that. What a start for the next chapter of Scottish motorsport history. There's always a worry that after time away events won't be as popular with local communities. People have moved in and don't like the noise or don't like roads being closed around their homes. Combine that with spectator deaths, and more specifically media in the case of Jim Clark, then a comeback will always be on a knife edge. After the fatal accidents and the inquiry in 2013, the Snowman rally in 2014, Jim Clark rally, lessons have to be taught from it for safety, safer rallies to have emerged. Now the consultation, the idea of motorsport governing body and local authority will provide road closure permits, has been a success. There's a small matter of getting it through Parliament. With Brexit forcing a logjam of legislation being pushed through, motorsport road closures could sail through with the tide or be washed up, abandoned on the shore. Judging by how quickly the results of the consultation were issued, one can only hope for the same when it comes to the bill and pushing through Parliament. People have spoken, and it's the closed road rallying in Scotland. Well wrote, Jack Benyon. And I think Ryan and I would be at the front of that to get that back. It's a rally I'd love to do again, right? I really would. I would really love to do Jim Clark again.
Fantastic event. Great support from that area as well. They really did a good job to get that event off the ground. And as it said there, it needs to support the local communities, but they were always really, really supportive and fantastic backing for the rally in that area.
Yeah, couldn't agree more. We're at any other business, believe it or not. So I've made reference to some of mine. Jack Benyon sent in as any other business.
Did he? What did he have to say?
Jack Benyon's any other business was, and it was more of a statement, or maybe a question, to you. Can you describe the biggest tantrum you experienced at the weekend?
Can I describe it?
Yeah.
The one that I witnessed.
Yeah. Or maybe it's the one that he witnessed.
I think it'd be the one that he witnessed when when I'd been stood at the bar for 10 minutes. And then when I finally got to the bar, the guy said, "We'll stop serving."
Yeah, that's pretty much you hit. He had a massive hissy fit.
Yeah, point out, I'd been stood there for 10 minutes and he basically said, "Don't care. It's not my problem and I'm not serving you."
Yeah, I know what a semi-junk crying champion who wants a bottle of Reds like.
I wasn't happy.
No, I can well imagine. Which one were you?
Slightly unhappy.
Okay, I thought you might be sleepy by that point anyway, but still, there you go. There you go. Race Retro, I had a little wander down there. I was down there on Friday for something else, so I had a little look round. It seems to be growing year on year. I wasn't there for the action of the cars out on stage. Unfortunately, I did see a lot of the static displays, and I did see some of the excellent cars that people have turned out. But, and I realise I'm on a really, really dodgy ground there because you're with me, Ryan Champion, but there's a big, big fear that there is so many cars that don't see the light of day anymore and don't turn a wheel in anger. And I appreciate, and I realise that you're going to give me both barrels in a minute when I finish this, but... And I appreciate how much it costs to fix these things and how hard it is to source parts and things like that. But there is a massive part of me that thinks it's such a shame that we just don't see these cars in anger anymore.
No, I absolutely agree with you. And to be honest, there's nothing more that I would like to do to take the Subaru in the forest. But it might only be a Group A car, but it's still the same running costs as a World Rally car. And I just can't afford to really take it in the forest. But I think what we're also finding is that, you know, a lot of the demonstration type events are obviously a lot cheaper for people because they, you know, the car doesn't necessarily have to be rebuilt before it goes. They can go and use tyres. They just, you know, it's a bit of fuel and they can go and enjoy themselves. And funnily enough, something that we touch on later with Kevin Ferber is that there's quite a social element to the events as well, which you very rarely get on the rallies now, and that's why some of the demonstration events are very popular, because you take your car, you have fun, you have a chat to people, and there's time for a beer at the end of the day, which doesn't happen in rallying. So maybe that's, you know, a little reflection on the rallies as well. But there was a fantastic array of cars there as ever, you know, huge amount of cars, 120 cars I think on the live stage. And I was lucky enough to get a little spin in a McRae 97 car and then a ProDrive 99 car on the Sunday as well.
Now, I seen the entry and I seen those pictures and nothing more fitting than seeing you in one of those, my friend. But I seen, was Paul Howarth driving one of those cars?
Paul was actually driving the 99 Subaru that I drove on the Sunday.
And that's Paul Howarth from ProDrive?
That is Paul Howarth from ProDrive, because he ran that car in period four, Freddie Dore. And Paul has driven most years at Race Retro, often in one of his own cars. But this year he was driving the 99 Subaru owned by Steve Rimmer, who has the Dirtfish Rally still in the States.
There you go. There you go. I did see that. And as I say, it's great. You know what? I feel really old though, because you just don't realize that, you know, as you say, 97, 99, you know, 22 years ago.
Yeah, these are old cars, and again, that comes back to to running them. They're not easy to run, and I know there's people out there saying, "Oh yeah, well my Escort's that age as well," but a lot of these Escorts don't have many period parts anymore.
No.
So it's when you have a Subaru, which its transmission was £40,000 in the late 90s, then they're not hard, not easy to get bits for, and certainly not easy to look after. So it's great, you know, it's good that people can still see the cars being driven and get up close to them as well. That's the other thing that people like about events like Race Retro. You just touched on it with spectators. People can mill about and see the cars close up. There's not so much time pressure that there is on a rally.
Absolutely. What's your any other business, my friend?
Mine, I've got a couple of things. Mr. Ken Block is coming to Donegal.
Yeah. Yeah.
in an Escort Cosworth that doesn't really look like an Escort Cosworth. Not sure on that one. Great news that Ken Block has committed to doing Donegal. I heard that he wanted to do it last year, but he is doing it this year in a new build Escort Cosworth that seems to have the body kit heavily influenced by current World Rally cars. So I think that's great news. And then any other business is rally cars that you shouldn't like, but you actually do. So this was requested by Mr. Henry Catchpole, who's been on the podcast before and does the brilliant car fiction videos and great work as a journalist and the video blogger. And he actually likes the Suzuki SX4, which is actually how we got on the subject, because Chris Meek was given the trophy for having the longest jump over Collins Crest, and it resembles a Suzuki SX4. He said, I quite like that. And then somebody else chipped in with, yeah, well, I really like the Seat Cordoba. And so we might bring this one back. I think we should bring this back.
I said we get Henry on when that happened, in fairness, because Henry has been on before. And he's a great sport whenever he comes on. So maybe we do need to get him
on.
We'll revisit this. But I think I made reference to the fact that the SX4 had a face only a mother could love. And it just looked like an SUV with gravel wheels onto me. So I was probably quite harsh on it. And I can say that now, Richard. I was working for Suzuki the year they did WRC as well. So I was involved with their program. But yeah, to be fair, only the Super 1600 Swift, I thought, was a good looking rally car in tarmac spec. Even the Ignis was an odd looking car.
Particularly the five-door variant.
Yeah, that was odd. It was just really odd. And then when they brought out the SX4, I must admit, I kind of went, again, it was probably a model they wanted to try and promote, and that was the reasons behind it. But have you got a guilty pleasure Ryan champion?
Well, I was thinking about it after we talked about it. There's a couple of cars that spring to mind. I love an Octavia WRC.
Yeah,
I think they're a very cool car. And the other one from a Group A period is the Sunny GTIR.
Okay.
Never very capable. Had a lot of problems, but I thought it looked cool and it sounded good.
You see, I wasn't at the time. I wasn't a massive fan of the Citroen Zara, believe it or not. Even though it was mega successful, it's only now retrospectively. Do I look back and that was my guilty pleasure, because I think I had a bit of a thing, right? In all honesty, I love the 206 and I knew there was this kind of Citroen Peugeot thing going on, and I kind of felt a little bit bad. I felt like I was cheating on the Peugeot.
And it was a bit bland as a road car, wasn't it? Sorry for anybody out there who had a Citroen Zara and loved it. I think Jack Smith, I think if you remember, Paul O'Neill had a Citroen Zara road car for a while, but, I just never particularly like Zara as a road car.
Yeah, so I felt a little bit bad. But now looking back, and you see some great images, and obviously it was Sebastian Loeb's birthday this week, so there was some images that went out with regards to commemorate his 45, and there was the Super 1600 Saxo, and obviously the Zara and everything else. But I suppose that's an easy guilty pleasure. I think, to be honest with you, that was an easy guilty pleasure. But anyway, listen, right, I think we'll probably all be back together next week, but we've got a busy rest of the show, so perhaps we shouldn't keep floundering around. Maybe we should get the guys on from Codemasters to tell us all about their 2.0.
It's great. That's all I need to say.
There you go. Folks, we'll be back after this break.
This is Absolute Rally.
Whether it's the pressures of service or an issue out on the stages, it's vital to have the right equipment to hand. Kielder cordless tools are tailored for the world of motorsport and are being used throughout all forms of competition.
Go back to the future with the Kielder Works team.
And welcome back to the next section of Absolute Rally. As we mentioned at the top, obviously we made reference to Dirt 2.0. It's a game which we've been quite passionate about over the years as well. You know, if you've listened to us for the 4 or 5 years we've been around, obviously we did stuff right at the beginning, and here we are now on the crest of a wave. 2.0 O is possibly at, well, I don't believe it, it's at its peak. I think it's very much on the ascendancy, but I thought it'd be a good time not to just get John Armstrong on, who normally comes on. Obviously, my co-host Ryan Champion, he's been involved as well, but I thought I'd get Ross Gowing on, who's the chief game designer behind it. So welcome to Absolute Rally, Ross, for the first time.
Thanks very much. Really great to be joining you.
Now, it's been a labour of love for so many people, and obviously the team that is behind the game now, it has become a team, hasn't it? Because, as I say, very, very early on, we remember when it was just some guys at Codemasters trying to get this thing going. But it has really formed almost the franchise, if I can call it that, as much as I'm not a big fan of that term, is really kind of grown and developed and evolved massively.
Yeah, it really has. I mean, so I worked on the kind of the early version with Paul back in the day, before going away to do other things and then coming back again. And you're absolutely right. It's kind of spun off into its own leg of the franchise. And it means that we're able to really kind of focus on the hardcore section of the community with this, whereas then the numbered dirt games, I think there's a bit more freedom to go away and explore things for kind of more entry level players. So yeah, I think the split works out nicely for everyone. And you're right, the team has sort of ramped up to a full development team rather than just a handful of people working away behind the scenes.
Is that going to be a conscious thing now that you've just made reference there to the numbered ones and obviously the non-numbered ones, if that's correct grammar in English, I'm not entirely sure, but the numbered one, they have a job, and the non-numbered ones, they also have a job. Are you basically trying to tick two boxes, as it were?
Yeah, I mean, certainly in my mind, Dirt Rally is where we are going for the serious stuff. I mean, my boss would probably dispute with me my description of it, but yeah, I think the numbered ones are where we're able to have, you've seen in Dirt 4, for example, like the joyride mode, that's not something that the core guys have been calling out for, but I think for someone who wants to take first kind of fun steps into what a rally car can do, that's a feature for them. And yeah, we want we want the numbered ones to be that kind of fun zone, and Dirt Rally to be the focused zone. I think that's about the most succinct way I can describe it.
I like it. It works for me. Works for me, Ross. Now, you know, we've flippantly said, you know, it was very much a cottage industry at the beginning, and we have developed this team, and you know, present company aside, obviously Ryan Champion is there on the side, sitting quietly at the moment, quiet as he's been for some time, it has to be said. You have surrounded yourself now with people, because as I say, you mentioned that you work with Paul. Obviously, Paul did, you know, the pace notes on the original one. Of course, now you've had these legends in, you know, Phil Mills, Stefan Prevo, obviously, you know, John has been there, Ryan's been there. Was that a conscious decision to actually bring in proper, I suppose, professional rally people?
Yeah, absolutely. So I mean, for take my own personal circumstances, I'm never going to be able to develop to be a driver competing at international level and able to translate that back into the game. So the best way to do it is to get the guys in who've got that experience, who've got that knowledge. And, you know, everyone you've just mentioned there has been so generous with their time and their expertise and their contacts. We think that's the way to make this better step by step, is to work with these people, take on board everything they're saying, and kind of push ourselves to think outside of the video game boundaries that we've previously worked under. You know, now it's how can we make things as real as these guys experience out there? And yeah, they're the best people to tell us how it should be done.
I guess the other thing as well, and I must admit, I kind of went on some of the Facebook groups and everything else on social media. Everything has been really, really positive and everything great. And but I seen somebody had actually gone to the trouble of producing a crib sheet. And, you know, we come from a rally background. Obviously, Ryan, myself, John, you know, all my co-hosts normally on this podcast, we've all competed at some point at various levels, international, you know, national and everything else. But I'd noticed very, very quickly somebody had put out a crib sheet to actually what the pace notes are, you know, the and they shared it round, and you know, there's a given I suppose to some degree that us guys are we know what overcrest means, and we know what titans and things like that. But there's generally gamers out there that are completely and utterly in love with the dirt concept that didn't have that. They didn't get that either, and someone's gone to the trouble already to produce a nice crib sheet for them.
Excellent. I mean, so I played the game over the weekend with a friend of mine who was not interested previously in rally at all, and I found that he only needed the kind of the basics of the numbering and severity system and distances explaining to him before he started to figure things out super quick. You know, overcrest he'd picked up, and caution he picked up himself as well. We want to be able to give those detailed notes that for people who come from a rally background, it feels accurate and kind of spot on straight away. And then I think players who've not come from that background, as soon as they've picked up the basics, they're then developing that appetite to go out there, find out what the more detailed calls mean, start to see how different drivers have famously used different call systems, you know, what personal taste of the top guys are out there. For example, when we were talking with Phil Mills about the level of detail for calls, the level of detail that him and Petter Solberg were doing for calls was unbelievable. I don't know how anyone can digest that much information at that much speed. So obviously we took it back a step from there, but still wanted them to be detailed enough to be real and to be useful at top speed. You know, I think you see some games in the past have gone with a very simple co-driver system, and that we didn't want to be there. We wanted to get this to be kind of industry leading for co-driver calls, if you will.
Now I'm going to bring Ryan in. It pains me to do it because obviously he's my co-host, but I'd be bringing him in purely because of what he's done. Right, obviously you've been involved with the game from very, very early doors as well. I know your background, and as much as it pains me to acknowledge how good you are at some of these things, because you're my mate, right? You're a very experienced test driver. You've shut down World Rally Cars. You've obviously done coaching, things like that. So you understand the dynamics of cars. How easy or how difficult is that to kind of get across to the guys that are producing a game? It's very easy to talk to an engineer with a rally car because he's done it a million times and is probably used to the language that you're using. How was the language thing for you to kind of get that across to them?
Well, I think as you've already touched on, and as Ross has already touched on, it is very much a team, and the development team behind the game want everything to be the very best it can be. So, you know, whether it's car handling or whether it's pace notes or whether it's the stages, you know, everybody's really keen to develop them as far as possible. And I have to say, from the car handling side, the guys that I've been working with the most directly, you know, they're really interested to learn how they can make the game better, because ultimately that's what they want to do. They want to make it as realistic as possible. So certainly that's something we've focused on throughout the development over the last year or so, is to make really concentrate on making the cars feel like they do in reality, and differentiating the cars as well. That's quite a big thing, so that all the cars have their own little character without engineering any false character into it. So it takes time, and I have to say some of the coding that you see done, and some of the thought processes, and some of the algorithms and graphs and charts and everything else that the guys have to come up with to try and put what I think is something simple into the game is incredible. It sometimes involves a complete redesign of maybe gravel, tarmac, tires, whatever it might be. So they work very, very hard to incorporate, you know, what those thoughts that I've got from reality.
Ross, did you actually take any of the guys, or obviously, I know obviously you had Ryan and John and obviously the older guys we've mentioned before, but did you have any, dare I say, non-believers? Did you have any non-rally people that we've now converted? Did we have to take them anywhere? Were we watching, you know, proper onboards, or did we take them to a rally? What did it take to get all the guys on, you know, dare I say, on the same hymn sheet, as it were?
I mean, I suppose to use perhaps one of the two new guys we brought into the team specifically for this project, who hadn't worked on rally games or had much interest in rally before. We started out by making them play an awful lot of Dirt Rally 1 and said, look, you need to understand what's come before us so that we can enhance that and improve on it. But yeah, now you do see those guys watching on boards on their lunch times sort of for fun. Some of the guys who've perhaps come from other areas of gaming that was their favorite type of gaming, all of a sudden they're stood next to you wanting the team to sign their copy of the released game and everything like that. And that's really great to see people becoming passionate about a sport that so many of us love. The hot topics of the day are always what's going on in rallying and what's going on in motorsport, and that love is infectious around the studio, really. We have a number of internal kind of message boards and internal Facebook groups where people can share around cool things they've seen or heard or chat about anything that's going on in the rally scene, and it is really great. And the more people read and interact, the more enthusiastic they become, and it all sort of feeds into the studio being full of a lot of motorsport nutters, really.
Now, obviously, all this stems from the great Colin McRae game. That's where it all started, so to speak. Now, I noticed on some of the packaging, where was the nod to Colin McRae 2? Where did that come from?
So that was our brand and marketing team led that one, and it's great. We've had the steelbooks doing the rounds in the office, and it's really fantastic to see how they've turned out. And I think the nod is great. So hats off to Christina and Matt and the rest of the brand and marketing team for coming up with that, and our operations team for getting it all sent through to manufacture and come back to such a high quality. I think it's a great steelbook to have on the shelf for sure.
Absolutely. Now, dare we say we're at Evolution 1. Will this game keep evolving? Is there going to be patches? Is there going to be additions? How is it going to work? And how do you see the lifespan of 2.0 to before we get to, is it 2.10 or is it 2.30? where do you see the lifespan of this game?
Now, numbering wise, that's an argument I often get involved in on email about how we're going to do the patch numbers, but we'll leave that to one side for now. But yeah, we've committed to kind of the next 6 months of both content and feature updates for the game. So content wise, you've seen us talking about the season passes and the locations and the vehicles that players will be able to get. But also with the features, the fixes and the improvements and patches, yeah, absolutely. We've got our social team currently sort of hooked into all of the internet forums and Reddit and what have you, collecting lists and evidence of everything that everyone's bringing up. We're playing the game ourselves as live players now and seeing what we want to tweak, what we want to adjust. I had a meeting only an hour ago where it was, okay, what can we turn around in the next day or two and get out in a quick update? What's going to take us another week to do and get that out next week? Everyone is sort of all hands to the pump on what we can do to iron out any early issues and build from there, really. So yeah, big plans. We just want to listen to what the community want and assess things and improve everywhere we can, really.
I can remember, and it will be unfair of me to name, but I can remember very, very early doors when obviously we made reference to when you guys tried to get this going almost as a cottage industry. There was a couple of brands that were perhaps reluctant to maybe have their cars in, or certainly they kind of dragged the heels perhaps a little bit for you guys. Has it been a much easier process when you're approaching manufacturers to get them on board now?
It's difficult to say, really. I mean, so there's obviously particular manufacturers out there that you're just not going to be able to get ever, and we kind of have to accept that in some cases. Our licensing team work incredibly hard across a number of projects to be phoning manufacturers, phoning the agencies that deal with manufacturers, and pushing everywhere they can to make sure that we can get the cars we want into the game. I mean, we're in a fortunate position that, I obviously can't give too much away, but it's less than a handful of cars we've been told this time around that we're not allowed to have. Obviously, the game being out there and the success of the previous game and hopefully the success of this game means that more manufacturers that we haven't previously been able to deal with will see us in the future and go, no, we want to be a part of what you're doing here. But at the same time, they're their cars. They hold the rights to them. If they just don't want them to be in the games, then there's nothing you can really do to persuade them otherwise. But yeah, it's not through a lack of trying at all. The licensing team do fantastic work, and anything we say we want, they'll go out and try to get it. It's just sometimes things outside of their control stop that from happening.
Because we rally fans, as I'm sure you and you are, Clash, you, of course, you're a rally fan as well, Ross. We're all very guilty, and we're all very guilty of having rosy-coloured spectacles, of course, and looking back. You know, all joking aside, obviously Ryan's stunning car was at the launch yesterday. Obviously that harps back to 95, 96. Is there a big demand from the community for the game to have the older vehicles, or are you still being pushed for the more modern stuff?
I suppose I always feel like we cover historic stuff pretty well. So we don't see a lot of chatter about it on online. You know, what you're doing well, people don't tend to speak up about in that respect. And I think we've got so many icons from across the years that the historic stable looks pretty good. We do get a lot of people sort of asking for super, sort of this year's vehicles, if you will, and where licenses and exclusive licenses that are held by other companies permit, we try and get as much new stuff in as we can. I think we've got a pretty good hit list from the 60s through to the present day, to be honest. I think whatever era of rallying you look back on most fondly, there's something there to enjoy.
Is there a limit of how many swear words you can say when you crash? Because I've got a 16-month-old son now, and one of the whole things holding me back, my other half, despite having all the rig and everything, it's right next to his nursery, and I'm not currently allowed to play it for that reason.
You'll have to get him kind of a tiny set of ear defenders, pop those on, and then I think you can go to town, really, can't you?
Happy days. Ross, it was I did the launch. God, it was down in Battersea, I think, for the previous game. How was the launch yesterday? Obviously, we have rally cars there, we have rally cross cars there, and you have plenty of people coming in. How was it yesterday?
Yeah, it was a really good vibe around Codemasters, to be honest. So the two cars being out front, and we had a balloon arch and a lot of banners, and I think people really enjoyed being able to have the photo taken with all of that. The company laid on a burger and chips meal for every member of staff, free of charge, to celebrate that. So we all had to have a little snooze about half an hour later because we were so well fed. But yeah, it's, you know, it makes everybody's hard work worthwhile once you get to that day when the game's finally out there and you kind of celebrate everyone's efforts, and you know, everyone can give each other a little pat on the back and enjoy playing the game. But then it's bizarre. I sort of woke up this morning with the feeling of, well, what do you do the day after you've run a marathon? Well, you better just get training for the next one, really, haven't you? But the feeling around the studio has been great, especially seeing people who it's the first game they've worked on, and sort of how happy they are to have been working on it, be part of it, and that kind of sense of satisfaction when you've all of a sudden you've shipped a title. It's really great to see.
Now, Russell, Tony and I, we've just said we come from a rally background. You're into rallying through the game, but I guess, how do you bridge the gap to non-rally people? What are the key things you've got to have in a rally game to appeal to both the non-rally people and the rally audience as well? What is it that stands out about rallying for you, for example?
I suppose the biggest contrast is always so many people are so familiar with driving your kind of your road car to and from work every day. And it's showing that as soon as you're driving on a loose surface, things change so dramatically, especially with rear wheel drive stuff. I certainly find that you almost have to wire your brain backwards to to get around corners properly. You know, you drive into work, you start to understeer into a corner on tarmac. What do? You know, you dab the brake and try and sort the problem out that way. Whereas all of a sudden in a rear wheel drive car, you're having to put the power down to keep the rear end coming around and point you in the right direction. So that's kind of the biggest thing for people to get their heads round with rallying, I guess. And it's up to us to provide them some kind of baby steps in that direction. We've got one tarmac location in the game in Spain, and starting on that with a front wheel drive car, such as, you know, one of the R2 class or go back to something like a Mini or a Fulvia, and kind of understand what the increase in pace is like, and having to listen to your co-driver calls, get used to that pace with at least some familiarity, so the front wheel drive and stuff on tarmac, and then being able to take that car, go off road somewhere like New Zealand, and start to get your head around how loose surfaces behave with a front wheel drive car, and building up from there. I think four wheel drive is usually where I'd recommend early doors players go next. It's that kind of pathway. I think giving people a taste of what rallying can be like, but in a virtual world, hopefully gives them an appetite for it, gives them an appetite to get out to real events and, you know, engage with the community. You know, we're lucky enough that dotted around the country, you can still go out and watch live rallying in kind of closed environments. And then I know, Ryan, you did a bit of the kind of the hill climb events with Shells of Walsh in particular last year. People are able to get out to that near to where they live at a low sort of entry cost and see what things are like in real life. And that, I think that's really what we want to try and build here. You know, do people go from playing the game to being a fan of the sport in real life? Do they go from playing the game at a high level to being able to take their first steps into competition, you know, on sort of nav runs and things like that? That's kind of really what we're trying to build, to be honest.
But the other thing, I guess, associated with that is you've got to appeal to gamers that maybe have an expectation from gaming, but you're also trying to aim towards it being an authentic simulation of rallying. So I guess that's a little bit of a balancing act as well.
Yeah, it is. I mean, obviously the work we've done with you on making the cars handle as authentically as possible is the key component in that. I think when you try and kind of over gamify some handling effects, it can distract and obfuscate sort of what's going on for real with the car. Whereas when things are kind of handling authentically, you've got genuine feedback from the game that you're able to kind of correct what you're doing. I suppose ice is one that is a good example to cite here. Again, people are used to driving on ice in their road car with, you know, kind of standard tires, if you will. And it's always like, oh, ice is really, really slippery. But then you speak to rally drivers like yourself, and as soon as you're on ice in a studded tire, you've got tons and tons of grip. And so it's kind of meeting those expectations that players have, but putting them onto the right lines, really. With a properly prepped car, you've still got grip. You just need to know how to manage it, really. I kind of hope that answers what you were getting at there.
Yeah, and one final thing from me then. What do you think your first memory of rallying is? You know, what's the first thing that you can remember really hit you about rallying?
My first memory of rallying, I was racking my brains, and I think it was watching Carlos Sainz chuck his helmet at his rear windscreen on grandstand on the telly. So I think that puts it about 97. And around that time, my dad had bought Network Hue Rally for our PC. And I remember playing that as it just being the most insanely hard game, playing on a keyboard as well, I seem to remember. And just thinking, oh my goodness, how am I going to get on top of this? And persistence was the key there for sure. Since then, I've always kind of been fascinated by that learning curve of being met with an extreme challenge and trying to take small steps and build up and overcome. And I think that's what you hear a lot about people rallying in real world as well. You take your first baby steps in junior competition and yeah, you have some setbacks and yeah, you might run out of money and you were so close to finishing in such and such position, but then something out of your control prevented you from doing that. But it's about going back and trying again. And I think that for me is what rallying is about. And as a result, that's what our game's about.
Ross, before we let you go, one last thing. Well, I want to say one last thing. It's probably a huge thing. For those who are familiar, obviously, with his predecessors, just what's new in the game? What are we? What else have we brought to the party?
So, I mean, two of our biggest features that we talk about a lot is our track degradation, which is the way that the surface will kind of evolve over the course of an event. And it was something that a lot of guys at national level had told us about when we were looking into it. The difference that being at the back of a field makes, you know, if you're super low in the running order and out of position almost, the ruts that other drivers are leaving behind and the struggle to overcome those, that was something we've gone big on. And so, yeah, you will see the different surface states throughout an event, and it does make a big difference. Along with that, we've got tyre selection as well, which is something our players had kind of requested for a while. So if you've got two or three long stages to get through, then you really are going to have to be fitting a kind of a harder compound, whereas if you're just trying to set a kind of a fastest individual stage time, then go for the soft option, and then obviously medium in between for when you want the balance. We've got a couple of different ways to play the game now. So historic championships are something where if you don't want to have to worry about managing a team, you just want to get out there and drive, then we've got rallying neatly portioned up into era championships for you, so you can just hop into something and get driving. And a similar setup with World Rallycross, so we're the official game of the FIA World Rallycross Championship, so you can select pretty much any car from the 2018 season and get out there and just start trying to set the fastest time in those heats and get yourself up onto the podium in the semifinals and finals. And then we also have a really flexible custom mode where you can set up championships to play solo or with your friends, however you want, any mixture of rally or rally cross, any cars and any locations you want. And then we also have a time trial mode as well, which it's for players who kind of want to put their times out there on leaderboards and show the world how good they are.
Just with regard to that, you just mentioned obviously the stages as well, and how the stages. One of the features of the last game, obviously, if you wanted to, you could go in and create your own stages and things like that. Have you moved away from that now? Have you got fully formed stages that you guys have put together that are perhaps a little bit longer now?
So yeah, in a similar way to Dirt Rally 1, all the stages are kind of handcrafted and bespoke, and that was something a lot of our players had talked a lot about. And the kind of the My Stage feature from Dirt 4 is something that we've always got an eye on how we could best use that in the future. But yeah, for Dirt Rally 2.0, they're fixed stages. But the surface degradation stuff that I mentioned really makes those stages feel different each time. You know, you can drive them 1,000 times, but there's ever such a slightly different challenge every time you go down them.
This is Absolute Rally.
Quarter, mid left crest, 8-6 right minus, tightens over jump, opens over 50, sharp left, tightens 5-6 on left crest, over 70, 5 right.
Ireland's leading commercial note supplier, Killian Duffy, has joined forces with 2016 British Rally champion Craig Parry to form On The Pace Note UK. For more information, visit the website onthepacenote.co.uk.
Welcome back to the final section of Absolute Rally. Obviously, we've been all about Dirt 2.0 at the top of the podcast, and obviously already the businesses and everything else. Now, one of the any other businesses which would have been probably Jack Benyon's this week, along with the other ones that he's actually sent me in advance, would have been the fact that he was at the Peugeot Awards. as was Ryan Champion, as was everybody else under the sun other than me. But the man who was behind it all was Kev Ferber. Kev, welcome to Absolute Rally for the first time.
No problem. Thanks for having me.
It's great to have you on. Ryan was at the awards. Ryan, obviously, as we say, is possibly the man who's done more one-make championships than anybody else in the world. So he seemed a good person to talk to you about what the awards was all about and why it was put together.
Well, Kev, we had a great night. All the better because Tony Simpson wasn't there, obviously. But
cheers.
It's all right. This was partly your brainchild, with help from some others. But how did it all come about, and why? Why did you do it ultimately?
It's hard to know exactly why, other than the great nostalgia, and the event itself was brilliant. But to go back, we've got to get back to 1988, 1989. Peugeot Challenge started, the brainchild of Des Adel, and how brilliant the championship itself was. And there's so many years and championships and outstanding performances from drivers and things that happened in those years, that certainly to mark the 30-year anniversary only seemed right. And actually, when I was asked by Craig Thorley, one of the original sponsors from the championship, and he was heavily involved in it, and it was his sort of idea, along with Ricky Evans, another great competitor from the 1990s, really, for the challenge. They just said, "Can we think you might be the man?" And the main reason they asked me is because I've got an events organising company, and we make video productions, so I tended to be the person that would have all the collateral, the memorabilia. I can film and make videos and run and organise events. But then I soon began to remember and realise that actually, as a driver, I've got a very significant interest in the championship, because in 89 as a driver I challenged with Paul Franklin for the outright win of the championship, and Paul won that year. And then in 1990 I did it again, and I won the senior section at the same time as Richard Burns winning the junior section. I went on to be a works driver for Peugeot for a few years, along with Paul Franklin and Richard Burns and Johnny Milner, and quite a few others, including Chris Burbeck, Simon Davison originally, Colin McRae even for a little while. And I started to really think through, just how brilliant those days were, and that they've never been, achieved since. And that's just in those couple of years of the start of the challenge. You move that on a few years from the Peugeot Challenge itself, and how it changed guys from 206s into, 309s and 306s. And then ultimately, the next significant year is probably 1999, when the 106 Super Cup was announced. And a lot of really good drivers re-energized that championship by buying brand new one-make championship cars and fighting for probably the biggest outright prize ever given in, or ever on offer in one-make championships in competitive motorsport. And that was a prize driving the WRC car, a car where nobody could get anywhere near a 206 World Rally car. And lots of prize money along the way, over £100,000 prize money. So that attracted an awful lot of really, really high quality drivers back from 1999 and the year 2000. And I was the carrot was dangled once again for me. So 10 years from when I first won the championship, I came back to compete in that year as well in 106s, and I finished third in that year. So I've done quite a lot in the one make championships and over decades. So from that point of view, I felt, I look at this and I do know a lot of people. There is so much history. And do you know what? I could come with one statistic that when I look back through all the records and history of the championship that blew my mind, which is that if you attribute about a £30,000 spend per competing crew for any given year of the championship, and go back to 1989, that was too much money, but certainly in the latter years people were spending that much. So if you cross that over with the amount of competitors over the amount of years, there's actually over £100 million spent by the competitors taking part in those championships. So it's a mind-blowing championship, even in just pure financial terms, because we're literally talking hundreds of competitors every year for 27 years. And Peugeot themselves, ran a whole competition department at any one time. They were running 5 British juniors in work-supported drives in cars. So they were pumping hundreds of thousands of pounds in. And indeed, within the championships, for the first 2 years, had £100,000 prize money, 1989 and 1990, given out to the drivers. And proud to say that of those 2 years, I probably won more money than anybody else. Even that was so significant to what happened with British Rallying. And then ultimately you've got things like Colin McRae came out of it world champion, Richard Burns came out of it world champion, several British outright multiple champions. You could even claim Mark Higgins came through the championships, and certainly David Higgins did. Johnny Milner was a big part of it. I hope I don't forget any names. Although there's probably one, which is yourself, Ryan. you played a massive part of the championship over its years. I've just said all of that for anybody that had forgot, and I almost had. And then you think, well, why did you want a reunion after 30 years? It's that. There's too much history to just let it go by unrecognised. And then I think the other significant thing to get over to people in a way is that this wasn't a manufacturer supported reunion party. It's not the Peugeot reunion. It's actually, the reunion from the competitors. It was organized by me as a competitor, not representing the manufacturer. And all the goodwill and ground support and people like yourself, Ryan, coming along, Ricky Evans, Rudy Lancaster, so many names, Steve Bennett and those type of characters, and Ricky Evans, they're all coming along with a table full of guests, and they're actively wanting to support it. So we paid for this event ourselves, and that's really significant. We weren't invited by a manufacturer, and the event itself was funded, with party organisers and great presenters on the night. All of that was funded by us. So people did think it was a manufacturer's event, but actually it was the competitors with so much groundswell of good feeling and positive energy, put on a great, great night. And linked in with Rallying with Group B's live show at Race Retro, we were able to take some cars to their live demonstration stage and have a reunion of Peugeot cars as well. And certainly I did some photo shoots with Johnny Milner and Paul Franklin, Keith Chipchase, taking us right, and Chris Burbeck, taking us right back to 89 and trying to fit into our old works overalls. So it was a fantastic event.
We'll not talk about you trying to get into your works overalls, will we? We'll skip over that one. But like you said, I mean, Peugeot had really a unique involvement, I would say, in British motorsport, didn't they? And it's something that a lot of one-make championships have tried to capture. But, I mean, when I started competing in 205s, there was something like over 60 cars registered, 60 cars on a round, and nobody has ever quite done it the same, have they?
No, they haven't. And there's one thing that slightly irritates me, and I'm sure people listening to this will be able to relate to this and might be quite shocked by my annoyance almost, but I'll share it as this is a good platform for it. But so many people say to me, oh, why don't we just start another Peugeot challenge? And myself and Pat Flynn did in 2005 and regurgitated a clubman's version of the championship, and that was backed by Peugeot, and we had a Peugeot Works Drive on offer for our clubman's winner. So, they had the ethics of the championship and people that were running Peugeot Talbot Sport and ultimately Peugeot Sport. They always want, they were good, grounded people in motorsport. And that's Mick Linford, for his tenure of about 12 years, Stella Boyles, Keith Board, and right from Desert Dell when he was running it in the early days. The bottom line of that is, they were proper motorsport people, and they understood from clubmans to international drivers what motorsport and rallying in particular was all about. Now, all that millions and all that effort that went into running those championships by really good, talented people and all the great competitors in it, and when people said to me, oh, maybe we should do it again, it's like you're having a laugh. Do you think for a minute you can come close to the hundreds of millions that's been spent and the talented people that have spent 27 years building the reputation of this championship, that you're just going to rock up with some clubman's specification 205 that's 30 years old and run the championship in the same guys? It's not possible. You can't achieve what's been achieved over those years, and I doubt whether anybody will ever do it again. So when people say other championships didn't quite live up, I think that does a real disservice to the people and the time and the effort and the money that's been spent for the 27 years. In fact, I think it's an insult. It's like, oh, anybody can do it. you know, they can't. It's a really, really mammoth task. So as much as I'd love to think that somebody could come up with a similar thing, I'm not sure it's ever possible because, you know, there's other championships, Evo championships, Vauxhall championships, you know, Micro Challenge championships. Anybody can think of anything. They don't come close to the millions that have been put in by drivers, you know, by good, talented people, you know, and the organisers to build what is the Peugeot, you know, Challenge Championship. It won't ever be done again. I can't imagine that it'll be ever, you know, replicated. And that's not to say people shouldn't try, but I think it's too simplistic to look at it and think, oh, we should start that again. Like some clubman sat in the kitchen can knock together a championship. It was way more important than that, you know, and even if from its concept, it had Desidel as the brainchild behind it and pushing it. It had the Peugeot financial backing. And Des is such an exceptional character that the years or 2 years that led up to the promotion of the first year of the championship as a pioneering engineering exercise, they had three full-time engineers working on the cars to get the correct specification for them and then put Colin McRae, Warren Hunt and Euro Roberts into prototype cars to run them for a year to make sure they were right before the championship ever started. So it's a way too simplistic for people to think they could ever capture the spirit of what this championship was about, and especially when there's no prize fund. You know, when, you, like say, 1989, let's be real about it, for 2 years I went rallying for nothing because I could compete and win more than it cost me to do the rallies. And that's, again, another impossibility. I can't imagine that anybody's going to come up with a fund that can afford a championship to run where you can go rallying for nothing if you win. So, you know.
Yeah, and you're absolutely right. And that's obviously one of the keys is that it had the manufacturer support there. And nowadays, these things pretty much have to pay for themselves, don't they, if they're operating?
Yeah, and you know, whether we tried it, myself and Pat, with our Clubman's 205 championship, and we ran in a Clubman's copy of what the Peugeot Challenge was about, and we did it with very little prize money, and really it was only their own competitors' input that we were able to give back as a prize fund. But even that had a £10,000 prize fund, you know, at stake. We had a prize drive backed by Peugeot that was on offer to us, and we had myself and Pat Flynn running it with great enthusiasm. But, you know, that was still, I guess, what I was getting to there. When we tried to run a similar championship, we were doing it with cars that were 30 years older. So the mixture of making another one-mate championship, or would this ever happen again? I really honestly think it can't. You know, I've got ideas of how you might do something similar, but it's just a unique, and you know, the more I've spent celebrating the 30 years, the more I look at it and the more I keep seeing it for what it is, which is how special and brilliant, and the fact that it will never happen again. So it's convinced me beyond belief that this 30 years and this championship is just so special. And it took Desidel to start it all and other absolutely key people along the way. It's like it was a perfect storm for 20 years of just the right people at the right time, right place with the right cars. Kev, you know, that's another critical element.
Kev, yeah. Can I ask a question? Sorry. I'm just conscious of time as well with you, but I did some of the other one makes as well, and the Peugeot one, which one we all wanted to do because the obvious reasons, but I think the Peugeot one, what was unique about it is, and you've already highlighted this, the term in inverted commas, and I'm doing inverted commas now as much as I hate myself for doing that, the term works driver gets thrown about quite a bit these days, as far as I'm concerned. It's a bit of a cheap kind of throwaway. But they were proper drives. You know, you think about obviously what you did, and you know, you effectively had a car prepared by Peugeot. You think about what Justin did, of course. You know, his time with Justin Dale, of course, his time with Peugeot and with, yeah, Mick Linford and everything. This was proper works drives. These weren't, you know, these weren't supported or you got a bit of money off someone. These were cars that were prepared and you turned up and drove.
Yeah, and maybe the critical part of that is Desidel had already won a world championship with Henry Toivonen. He'd proven himself as a manager of great, talented people and capable of winning world championships. We were being told what to do and controlled and driving for Desidel. with his mechanics, his team, people that have won world championships. So it's the equivalent to walking into M Sport now. You know, they didn't have massive budgets. You know, yeah, we worked drivers. We weren't on big contracts. I don't think that even existed then. You don't know they had ever had a massive contract. But what you did have is a works team manager who shouted at you if you crashed his car. and it was, you know, really old school. And they say those days have gone. But Tez loved it as well. You know, I've got to say that he loved having five people in his cars at any one point. And he did some... You know, just to tell you one story, when I, very early doors when I first met Des, he took myself and Colin McRae and Warren Hunt into the Humber Road factory, and brand new 309 GTIs were rolling off the production line, and one every 3 minutes came off the production line. And he said, "Look, we make a car every 3 minutes here, one of these 309s, and you know what that means, don't you, young lads?" We looked at him and didn't really know what to say or how to react to him. And, well, you know, maybe they're all precious and we should look after them. And he said, "I brought you here to prove that I can build them faster than you can crash them."
You did try and prove that wrong at one point.
Well, do you know what? That's, again, another thing about worse cars. I can't imagine this happening now, but the ethics of whether you could crash a worse car or not is... If the car had done enough mileage, done a couple of rallies, this is the body shells type of it. It was wasted. It was going to get, you know, replaced anyway. The body shell was almost meaningless. The only thing that Des got annoyed about is if you lost the result. So the crashing of a car meant nothing to him. But if you lost the result that they needed for points or to win the championship, then he would be fairly offended by the fact that you'd thrown away the PR opportunity. But the other thing, from Des's point of view, he would never be beaten. So from a class point of view, if you were second, you may as well crash, because we could never be beaten by a private team. So if you weren't capable of living up to that, then you can't drive for him. So, you've got to understand the responsibility of the driver at the time. One, never be beaten by anybody else. And number two, if you're on your third rally in the same show, well, you need some form of outstanding result. Otherwise, you know, just bringing it home safely and it's nice and in one piece makes no difference to them. They're going to reshell it anyway. So, you're under pressure to come up with a giant killing performance on every single rally. So that's now when everybody says, you know, be reliable and let Elvin Evans, he's got to get there and build his performance up slowly. Of course you have to, because the cars are phenomenally expensive. But it wasn't like that then. They were usable, you know, they were throw-away items in many ways. The only thing you couldn't throw away was the result. So you were driving for the result, but if you damage the car, insignificant. And then those days have gone, and they're sad, you know what I mean? Now it's too expensive, you can't afford to have the accident.
Absolutely. I'm going to hazard a guess, the bar bill from Saturday possibly could have paid for a works car to do Rally GB this year.
Well, it would have done, but we took the hotel by complete surprise, and the five bar staff they had on all night weren't able to cope.
That's like coming into service with a roll car and only one mechanic, basically.
it felt a bit like that.
it 100% did. Anybody was there, and Steve Deeks, as the sort of main presenter with myself and Ryan helping present live, came up with the conclusion that he said, if there's an equation for how many bar staff you need per person, member of the public who wants a drink, if it's in rallying terms, it should be one for one.
Yeah, absolutely. Listen, Kev, congratulations to you and the guys behind it. I'm assuming, you know, you're now preparing for what is the next one. Is that going to be the 35th, do you think you'll do? How are you going to do this next?
It's interesting. I mean, the thing I haven't touched on there is the other overall conclusion that kept us all together. Why did we all come back? It wasn't just the ferocious competition or the money or anything else. We were all great friends, and there were so many stories of friendships. You know, myself and Ryan have competed against each other, and if I go right back to Paul Franklin, after 30 years, I'm able to ring Paul up as a friend and say, "Jay, do you fancy, you know, a night out? It'd be great to catch up." So all the way through that event, from, you know, mechanics to drivers to ferocious competitors like myself and Johnny Milner, you know, real serious teammates for years and years, but after 30 years we can still, you know, be really good pals with each other and have a drink and have a great time. I think that's missing in rallying, and I think we all noticed that doesn't happen anywhere near enough, you know, that especially with modern day rallying, it's so cutthroat, you know, that that it was a pleasure to be around people, and the family feeling and the friendships that came through on the night, as much as I thought this is never going to happen again, I've got a sneaking suspicion that it will happen again, because we realise that it's too long and life's too short. You know, and we should get back together, and rallying should be a social sport, and it has no reason why we can't make more of a habit of bumping into each other than once every 30 years.
Well, listen, Kev, again, congratulations to you and the guys, and you know, well done, and thanks for coming on and telling us all about it, because we, you know, it's something we've spoke about one makes off and on for pretty much all the years we've done this podcast, to be honest with you. So it's great to get the insight, and obviously the insight from the time at Peugeot. So hopefully we'll get you back when you've got a bit more time, and maybe we'll talk more about the yesteryears of Peugeot Sport.
Yeah, more than happy to do that. And if I could take the opportunity to thank Ryan for his efforts, he helped us do the live presentation. We know he's all great at that. But also, we gave a little bit of support for Ryan's campaign for his, you know, well, for his personal awareness campaign with kids with Down syndrome. And we sold a prize on the night to have a chauffeured run with Ryan, and we raised over £700 for Ryan. So, you know, I'm really proud of that came from the event. You know, thanks, Ryan, for all the help that you gave us on the night.
No, thank you, Kevin. Thanks for doing it.
There you go. Folks, that has been the podcast for this week. You know where we live. It's Absolute_Rally on Twitter, facebook.com/Absolute Rally. All the old episodes, absoluterally.co.uk. We'll be back same time, same place in your little podcast hole next week.
Absolute Rally, powered by the Kielder Works team. Spread the word and download the podcast every week.